are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us are chained. None of us are free. And there are people still in darkness.
Uhuru. You're listening to Reparations in Action here on UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. Reparations in Action is the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee, the organization of white people working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, organizing in the white community to build solidarity with the struggle of African people for self-determination, liberation, and reparations. Welcome to this week's show. It is February 15th. My name is Jamie Simpson. I'm your host here in the studio with our engineer, Darren St. Pierre. So glad to have you, Uhuru Darren. And today we are going to be discussing resistance and sports, colonialism and sports, from Muhammad Ali to Marshawn Lynch. Now, I have to make a couple of disclaimers before discussing this. I am no sports expert. In fact, I did not grow up as a big fan of sports. I did take some exception to the sexism, racism, and intense masculinity expressed in many U.S. sports in my personal experience. However, this pairs in comparison to the exploitation and resistance that African people and oppressed people have faced in just trying to participate in the public sports industry, in big sports, from everything from boxing to basketball to the NFL. We want to begin today by discussing the intersection of the anti-colonial movement and the movement of African people to be independent and sports. And in a lot of ways, that begins in this country with the concept of something called the Great White Hope. The Great White Hope was a response to the shooting to prominence of Jack Johnson in the realm of boxing for the heavyweight. Jack Johnson was an African and had to struggle against intense racial hatred, white nationalism, and a lack of African people even being allowed to compete against white people in order to become the world champion. And when he did, it threatened white power imperialism to its very core. The very fact that an African man was able to consistently defeat both other black opponents and white opponents in the ring and remain with his head held high. Jack Johnson was not known to be an insecure person or someone who was not proud of his accomplishments. And this threatened all of the assumptions that white power has always had about African people. The understanding of Jack Johnson and the period of history in which he occurs is also important. And I want to say this about sports in general too, backing up a moment. We in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement understand the very healthy role that sports has played in the past. In pre-colonial times, for instance, the sport of indigenous people, of African people throughout the world, time and time again, is an excellent example of an expression of that culture's interrelationship with different groups of people, pride in physical fitness, exhibitions of athleticism. Even the ancients, even ancient Greece, for all of its contradictions, the fact that it was a slave-owning society, the original Olympics were a much more localized phenomenon, with the Athenians playing against other Hellenistic groups. It was only when the Roman Empire took over the Greek Empire, previous to it, that the Olympic Games became a real stage for airing imperial arrogance. And this intensified with the founding of the Olympics in 1896 in Greece, which would not have happened without U.S. and British support. Now, 1896, this is a period in history not long after the Berlin Conference, as we understand it through studies that we have been led through in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, through the understanding of African internationalism developed by Amalie Oshetola and the African People's Socialist Party, We understand that this is a time in history, the scramble for Africa, when Africa is being sliced up by imperial powers like France, like Britain, increasingly at that time like the United States. And it's in this context of colonial competition for Africa and other colonized places that we see the birth of the Olympics in 1896 on the one hand. And here in the States also, it's not long after that, in the beginning of the 20th century, that we see the phenomena of Jack Johnson. And also shortly thereafter, a good deal after there, we have Jesse Owens astounding the world, astounding Adolf Hitler, and the concept of Aryan supremacy, an African defeating white opponents in the realm of running in the, I believe it was the 1933 Olympics in Germany. So we have a basic philosophy that is the underpinning of white colonialism, white settler colonialism, and that is racism being challenged time and time again in the arena. While at the same time, it's understood that boxing is a form of brutal gladiatorial entertainment at times for white people. And the conditions of safety were certainly not very high for the African population fighting in the ring. And exploitation was rampant. Yet at that same time, we have the Garvey movement. We have African people coming into organization, starting to resist their conditions. And in this nation, the notion, as we understand it from Chairman Amalia Shetela's recent book, An Uneasy Equilibrium, the notion of whiteness, the notion of what it is to be white, right, means the concept of being both white and Christian. That's always an element of it. Increasingly in this country, we're seeing white people move away from religion, and at the same time, we see things like the Super Bowl. We see things like the World Series moving into an almost sacrosanct position, right? Almost a mystical position. If anyone listening, any of our listeners, and I appreciate everyone who's tuning in today, paid attention to the Super Bowl, we see the fanfare at halftime increasing in its imperial arrogance, the glitz, Katy Perry prancing around in a highly sexualized and, I might add, infantilized manner is very indicative of the superstructure of imperialism. And this is one format that the U.S. ruling class can be sure it will gain a large audience from. It's been said internationally that in some nations, the only thing that can bring out hundreds and thousands of people to the streets is either a political revolution or a big soccer or football match. This reality is not lost on the ruling class of the imperial nations. And we would do well to understand it ourselves, not as a way to dismiss sports, but in fact as a way to separate what can be political theater, what can operate, as we've seen recently in the era of Ferguson, in the era of Mike Brown's and Eric Garner's being publicly lynched. We're seeing slandering of African men through the discussion of violence in sports. And we've also seen brave resistance on the part of some of those people in the NFL. Case in point, the Rams in St. Louis. After Mike Brown was killed, one of the first games they came out with the hands up, don't shoot, which was a universal gesture in solidarity with people protesting the murder of Mike Brown and conditions for African people in this country. So that's a brief overview. I'd like today we're going to discuss the two aspects of sports, the colonial exploitation of colonized people that we've seen throughout the history of sports in this country and the world, and also resistance to colonialism and the stance of independence and self-determination exemplified through people like Jack Johnson, like Muhammad Ali, and today increasingly some people think like Marshawn Lynch. Let's go now to our first clip about Jack Johnson and put that into some historical perspective. I believe we're ready for this clip now. We go to Our Black History, discusses Jack Johnson.
Perhaps the most famous, notorious, and unforgivable black man of his time. Jack Johnson, nicknamed the Galveston Giant, was the first black heavyweight boxing champion. Born in Galveston, Texas on March 31, 1878, Johnson was a man that knew how to get around the rules that were meant to oppress him. He started boxing as a sparring partner and fought in battle royal matches, in which young blacks entertained white spectators who threw money to the winner. He turned professional in 1897, and by 1902, Johnson had won at least 50 fights against both white and black opponents. He won his first title on February 3, 1903, by defeating Denver Ed Martin over 20 rounds for the World Colored Heavyweight Championship. At the time, black and white boxers could meet in other competitions, but the World Heavyweight Championship was off limits to them. Johnson finally won the World Heavyweight title on December 26, 1908, when he fought the Canadian champion, Tommy Burns, after stalking Burns around the world for 2 years and taunting him in the press for a match. The fight lasted 14 rounds before being stopped by the police in front of 20,000 spectators. The title was awarded to Johnson on a referee's decision as a TKO, but he had clearly beaten the champion. His dominance over white opponents sparked furious debates and race riots in the early 20th century. Johnson was an early example of the celebrity athlete in the modern era, appearing regularly in press and later on radio and motion pictures. He earned considerable sums of endorsing various products, including patent medicines, and indulging in several expensive hobbies such as automobile racing and tailored clothing. As a black man, Johnson broke a powerful taboo of the time in consorting with white women. His three marriages, all of whom were to white women, caused a considerable amount of controversy. Johnson would constantly and arrogantly verbally taunt men, both black and white, in and out of the ring. He was said to be the white man's worst nightmare. Johnson was inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame in 1954. His skills as a fighter and the money it brought made it impossible for him to be ignored by the establishment. In short term, the boxing world reacted against Johnson's legacy. But Johnson foreshadowed, in many ways, perhaps one of the most famous boxers of all time, Muhammad Ali. In fact, Muhammad Ali spoke of how he was influenced by Johnson. Johnson's legacy continues to inspire many in and out of the boxing world. This is Our History in Black.
Uhuru. Uhuru, that was Jack. That was a brief overview of the legacy of Jack Johnson, famous hero of the boxing world and the African working class. And it's important to remember the incredible frenzy that the question of Jack Johnson created for white power. It made it necessary for them to find a white athlete. And, you know, I can't even remember his name off the top of my head. I didn't do the research into the Great White Hope. But this is where the origin of the Great White Hope came from. And that question, a question about the identity of the Great White Hope, wound up on the IQ test, which was formulated as a way to determine who would be an officer and who would be infantry in World War I. And one of the key questions was the identity of the Great White Hope, not Jack Johnson. So very, very telling how interwoven in our imperial legacy is in sports. It is very much part of the superstructure of this white settler colonial state called the United States, called Western Europe, or as we say in the Uhuru movement, white power imperialism. Now, we want to move on in history, particularly in the United States, and talk about the transition that happened between the two inter-imperialist wars known as World War I and World War II. And after World War II And during this period, of course, as I said before, we see African veterans coming home with a new perspective on the world, a new perspective on Jim Crow law, on regular lynchings, on so much poverty in their communities that they can, barely get from week to week in terms of subsistence. And the idea of two things, celebrity through entertainment or sports, athleticism, have always represented a way out of that poverty. And the way that the imperial media presents this to the African community is a very unhealthy one, a sort of a ticket out, a leave your community behind suggestion. And there have been people who have been willing to participate in that dynamic. But there have also been people who have resisted that trend, who have refused to play the docile role, the tame role, the assimilation role, who have been proud of who they are. And one person who has exemplified that possibly more than anyone else in this century is Malcolm X. Malcolm X represented, as I believe Ossie Davis once said, black manhood, pride in being African, the concept of black as beautiful, which of course was started by Marcus Garvey, but carried out also in Malcolm X's work on every level. And when Malcolm was first becoming a national figure, the question of getting his personality out there, his analysis out there, was a critical question being discussed by the civil rights movement, by the white power structure, by the nation, even within the Nation of Islam. The ability of Malcolm X to relate to African workers, to the struggle of African people worldwide, was transcendent. And it's around this time that we see an up-and-coming fighter named Cassius Clay convert to Islam and change his name to Muhammad Ali. And Muhammad Ali, in and of his own personality, what he achieved in the boxing realm, what he achieved politically, forwarded this idea of black nationalism and black African internationalism in a way, whether he was fully conscious of it or not. His absolute pride in his ability, his confidence, his swagger, his interspersal of quote-unquote trash talk with a kind of poetry, right? A kind of poetry whose enemy always was white power when it came down to it. He might have talked trash about Sonny Liston, about Joe Frazier, about George Foreman, but there was no enemy to Muhammad Ali more formidable than the white power structure, especially when he was at his peak. And we want to move now to a brief clip of Malcolm X speaking about his friend and brother, Muhammad Ali. I bring you now the great Malcolm X.
The power structure had successfully created the image of the American Negro as someone with no confidence, no militancy, and they had done this by giving him images of heroes that weren't truly militant or confident. And now here come Cassius, the exact contrast of everything that was representative of the Negro image. He said he was the greatest, all of the odds were against him, he upset the odds makers, he won, he became victorious, he became the champ. They knew that as soon as, if people began to identify with Cassius and the type of image he was creating, they were going to have trouble out of these Negroes, because they'd have Negroes walking around the streets saying, I'm the greatest.
That was Malcolm X speaking about the greatest, the great Muhammad Ali, formerly Cassius Clay. And I did want to say, you're listening to the Uhuru News Network, Uhuru Radio. This is Reparations in Action, the weekly show of the African People's Solidarity Committee. My name is Jamie Simpson. I'm your host here in the Uhuru Radio studio with my engineer, Darren St. Pierre. I want to say thank you to Darren, and thank you to the entire Uhuru Radio staff and the African People's Socialist Party. So we're continuing to discuss today on Reparations in Action the question of the role that sports historically has played itself out in the colonial epic, or rather the way that the colonial epic has expressed itself through the format of sports over and over and over in myriad ways. We were just talking about Muhammad Ali, and we're going to hear from Ali briefly. Muhammad Ali shocked the world with his bravado, with his quick float like a butterfly, sting like a bee moves, his spoken word poetry, and his conversion to Islam and joining the Nation of Islam, and how militant he was about that. I think the phrase is, say my name, right? Which actually had a lot to do with, was it Sonny Liston? I'm forgetting which opponent it was, but some of his opponents refused to call him by his assigned name, by the name he chose, Muhammad Ali, the name given to him by Elijah Muhammad, which was incredibly sacred to him. And I think it speaks volumes about this tendency in the history of colonized people and African people in particular, of seizing the right to redefine the narrative. And this is what we're seeing throughout the world today. That's what Muhammad Ali did by insisting on that name. That is his name. And he let go of his slave name and was very militant in upholding who he was. I want to bring you now a clip from Muhammad Ali regarding his decision to refuse the draft and refuse to partake in an imperial war against the people of Vietnam. This is Muhammad Ali on the Vietnam War.
Ali defeated Foley by a knockout in the seventh round. Immediately thereafter, he walked into the teeth of a monumental decision. He was drafted, and then he refused induction on the grounds of his religious convictions on war.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. What, I'm going to shoot them for what? How am I going to shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? Just take me to jail.
While fighting imprisonment for his stand, Ali was also stripped of his title, denied a license to fight in the United States, and denied a visa to go overseas to fight. He was in a much tighter financial bind than most were aware of.
I don't want to see the world heavyweight champion driving a Volkswagen, guys in the Cadillacs and making fun of you. So I'm working today, I'm hauling, right? I'm moving. And so one day I had a speaker, Canisius. Heard of Canisius? Canisius, Ferdinand Dickinson, C.W. Post. Three colleges at $1,500 a college. Pretty good money. So I broke my wife's piggy bank. She had about $35 in it. $135. I broke the piggy bank to get gas money to get me to the college. And I got enough gas and food money to get the $4,500, the $1,500 lecture. At $45 would hold me, pay gas bills, light bills, till I get to the next college. This went on until that whole mess was over.
Inevitably, students would challenge Ali on his stand and his convictions. Remarkably, Ali more than held his own against students who had a far better formal education than he.
I'm saying you're talking about me, about some draft, and all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now, right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Congs or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
That was the amazing Muhammad Ali speaking to a group of white college students. And his words ring as true today as they did then. You're my enemy, white people, when I want justice, when I want freedom, when I want some way out of oppression. Not the Viet Cong, not the North Vietnamese or the National Liberation Front was derisively called by U.S. Imperialists. It's something that war is something that Muhammad Ali refused to partake in on principle. And because he refused to partake in it on principle, he paid a heavy price. And we hear that. We hear the hustling in terms of making ends meet that he had to do. And here is the heavyweight champion of the world. So in a way, the imperialists can pick you up through sports and hand people medals, turn them into celebrities. But at the same time, throughout this country to this day, we see African athletes whose families live in poverty, who they themselves wind up living in poverty when the peak of their physical condition is over, when they have been fully exploited by this system. We hear discussion of concussions and the lack of responsibility that the NFL is taking for players who wind up with brain damage from the number of collisions and concussions. Now, I'm speaking of football there, but the same goes for boxing. But what Muhammad Ali represented lives on. And it lived on, and it must not be taken out of the context of the period in which it happened, the period of black power, the period where the image of an African person as proud to be black, as politically astute, more politically astute than the average white person, politically militant. This is the context in which we also see a fascinating development that we're going to talk about after the commercial break, that happened in the Mexico City Olympics of 1968, because there were a group of people, several organizations, that took up the call of Malcolm X and took it beyond the question of religion and took it into the political realm. Groups like the Junta of Militant Organizations, which would later take part in forming the African People's Socialist Party. Organizations like those that Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale created in California, the Black Panther Party, which was influenced in large part by the kind of radicalism that was coming from the South, from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which also has ties to the Uhuru Movement in terms of founding organizations that Chairman Omali Eshetela was involved in. So this is the period, the same period in which this organization was born. We see Muhammad Ali and we see Black Power as a theme throughout this nation and throughout the world. So much so that there is a runner by the name of John Carlos and his friend Tommy Smith, who would go on to make world history with what they did in the 1968 Olympics. And we're going to discuss that amazing history after these public service announcements.
Uhuru, I am the real sun, and I'm here to stand in solidarity and support Burning Spear Media. Burning Spear Media keeps alive African culture from North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the world. We have not forgotten about the Bandung Conference of 1955, where leaders of African and Asian nations came together to stand in solidarity against colonial oppression. Burning Spear Media makes it possible to keep memories like these alive by honoring history and remembering legacy. It is owned and controlled by the Black working class, and it is one of the oldest newspapers to be in continuous publications since the civil rights movements of the 1960s. Leaders and organizations all over the world have been crushed for standing up for the voice, power, and rights of Black people all over the world. And yet, Burning Spear Media lives on. I support Burning Spear Media and Uhuru News and Radio, which connects African people all over the world. Will you?
United We Fight, the African Internationalist Conference on African Women, is being sponsored by the African People's Socialist Party.
March 21st and 22nd at the Stewart Center, 821 Vernon Street, Northeast in Washington, D.C.
Get involved and register now for issues African women face. Political and social oppression, economic exploitation,
underemployment, social immobility.
End to the political and social oppression, bringing African women into political life.
Register now at www.apspuhuru.org/AI Women's Conference
or call 202-642-4672. That is 202-642-4672.
For the Conference on African Women, Saturday and Sunday, March 21st and 22nd in Washington, D.C. www.apspuhuru.org/AI Women's Conference.
Uhuru, thank you for those announcements, Darren. You're listening to Reparations in Action here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Jamie Simpson, here in the Uhuru Radio studio. Thank you for tuning in. Today's show is entitled Resistance and Sports, from Muhammad Ali to Marshawn Lynch. And we will get to Marshawn Lynch, but first we need to go over all the amazing heroes of the sports world who have stood in defiance of colonial exploitation and colonial conditions. Just before the show, I mean the commercial break rather, we heard a brief clip from Muhammad Ali speaking out against the Vietnam War, saying, why would I want to go and murder some more dark-skinned, oppressed people in the name of what? Of the conditions that you have here for me in the United States? It rings incredibly true today. The same question could be asked of the United States trying to recruit people to go and fight in Afghanistan, or to support a president who would send drones to kill 16-year-old children in Pakistan, in Iraq, in Syria, or police, for a society whose police goes out on the streets and murders African men, women, and children at least every 28 hours in this country, including children as young as 7 years old, as 12 years old. But I digress from the question of the sports, and I don't at the same time. These two issues are intertwined, and they were intertwined for John Carlos and Tommy Smith. These are two Olympic heroes who shook up the world with an act that went beyond symbolism in its power, because it was tied to organization, because it came from a time when these two athletes were coming from the California area, San Jose, if I'm not mistaken, the same place where the San Jose Mercury was, where later Gary Webb would expose U.S. imperialism for bringing crack cocaine into black communities. This is the community from which John Carlos came of age and became an Olympic hero. And they made an organized decision about what they would do in winning this race. And just the athleticism displayed by the two is amazing enough. But the determination afterwards to approach the podium, if you will, and to put on black gloves and raise their fists high in a black power salute to the world was something that reverberated throughout the colonial world and was something that was only possible in the context of so much organized resistance on the part of African people. By 1968, we already have in full motion the junta of militant organizations here in the St. Petersburg area. We have the Black Panther Party already on the scene, making struggles around the question of infrastructure for the African community, around basic things like breakfast for children and clothing and housing and a lack of fear from the police, the right to live without constantly being in fear of brutality or murder at the hands of police or a white vigilante. These were the issues around which the Black Panthers organized, taking up the call of Malcolm X, taking it to the streets. And this message was not lost on John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Even in their exercise, even in their training, their organizing, they had, and you'll forgive me, I'm forgetting the name of their running organization, but it indicated a kind of militant stance, even in the way that they approached sports. And I think that this is something that's significant in a time when we see things like Deflategate. We see things like the Patriots, who just won the Super Bowl, being a team known for cheating. No, documented. They have paid fines, which they can afford to pay, for spying on other teams' plays, for using a ball that wasn't completely inflated. And even this recent Super Bowl, that last call made by the Seahawks coach has been much in question. And I think that colonized people who have to do this to reach other colonized people, who enter sports because the only other option is poverty and obscurity, do so with a different type of motivation and do so with a type of sincerity and honest sportsmanship that might possibly save the sense of sports, save what is good about team sports and competition. And to me, that is why we are upholding John Carlos and Tommy Smith today and what they did. In the following clip by David Zarin, we'll walk you through that proud day in Mexico, 1968. I bring you now the 1968 Olympics, the Black Power Salute.
Embodied in athletes like Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who turned American sports culture on its head in the late 1960s.
There's Cuesta, it's a good start. And Carlos, as usual, has burst out of the blocks. Tommy Smith running pretty well so far. And in lane two, Bombuk is strong on the outside. It's Edwin Roberts. It's John Carlos right now. It's Carlos and Smith. And here comes Tommy Smith!
They won a gold and a bronze medal at the 68 Olympics, and what they did next couldn't stand in starker contrast to today's depoliticized, sanitized, and hyper-commercialized sports world. They didn't pull a Jordan at the 1968 Olympics and use their platform on the global stage to protect an endorsement deal. No. These guys had a point to make. As they walked to the platform, they took off their shoes and carried them to protest poverty in America. They wore beads to protest lynching, and John Carlos even unzipped his jacket, a violation of Olympic protocol, to represent, as he told me, his working buddies, black and white, back home in New York City. And in perhaps the most famous gesture in Olympic history, they raised their fists during the national anthem to show solidarity with the civil rights movement. Their symbolic gesture inspired millions around the world, but their punishment was swift and severe.
Good morning to you. The Olympic Games are 1 week old today, and yesterday, the sixth day, was the most dramatic so far. It started with the news that the Black Power disciples Tommy Smith and John Carlos, the Olympic 200 meters gold and bronze medalists, had been suspended by the United States Olympic Committee and given 48 hours to leave Mexico.
I had said that if there were any demonstrations at the Olympic Games by anyone, the participants would be sent home.
Smith and Carlos were expelled from Olympic Village. Their athletic careers were ruined. For years, they received death threats and were treated like traitors to their country. They couldn't find good jobs. Their wives and children suffered.
Do you think the Olympic Games are the right place to do this kind of thing? You ought to use this as a kind of world stage?
David, since we are athletes, although I am a teacher, but I'm not a politician, we use this so the whole world could see the poverty of the black man in America.
At the same time, cynics might say that you've got it all. You've got publicity, you've got medals, you've got martyrdom as well. What do you say to that?
I can't eat that. And the kids around my block, they grew up with me, they can't eat it. And the kids that's going to grow up after them, they can't eat publicity. They can't eat gold medals, as Tommy Smith said. All we ask for is equal chance to be a human being. And as far as I see now, we're five steps below the ladder. And every time we try and touch the ladder, they put their foot on our hands and don't want us to climb up.
Moments like these are a crucial part of the history of American sports, part of a long legacy of struggle and courage in the face of injustice that has largely been forgotten as politics has come to be considered not only inappropriate in the arena of sports, but actually antithetical to it. We want so much to see sports solely as an arena of play, not seriousness. But here's the thing. This can cheapen not only the greatness and relevance of sports to us as a society, but also the courage of athletes. And we do an injustice to them and to what's best about sports when we sanitize the past and rip athletics out of the political and cultural context it has always been a part of. Keeping our mouths shut in the face of injustice may help us make fun of others and silence them and assure that we stay popular with the keepers of normality. But real courage means standing up when it's not popular. And real men and real women don't ask permission to raise their fists.
Uhuru, really appreciate that YouTube clip from, that's Dave Zarin. Cannot say that we endorse every one of his articulations of what sports means, but a lot of realities, of truths were expressed there. And I entirely unite. Real men, real human beings do not ask permission to raise their fists. And we are humbled by the courage of both John Carlos and Tommy Smith and what they represented to the world. You know, this is happening in the context of intense colonial oppression of the world and intense resistance to that oppression. At this time, 1968, we're seeing the Vietnam War rage. We're seeing the people of Vietnam, after having defeated the French colonial forces, in the process of overturning U.S. colonial domination, the largest military on the world being in the world rather being defeated by determined Vietnamese revolutionaries. We are seeing this at the same time that the U.S. was sent running out of Cuba in its attempt to invade there in the Bay of Pigs, having just recently murdered Che Guevara in the jungles of Bolivia in 1968. We're seeing this at a time of intense conflict between the U.S. and Russia in the so-called Cold War. So these are not politically, these are not apolitical times. No time is. And the superstructure of any society is going to express that, as it is with sports. We turn now to the NCAA, or the National, College Athletic Association. I'm a bit behind, as you can tell. I'm not a sports guy. But this is an important issue. Increasingly, we're hearing analysis of, in particular, football, but also college basketball, the intercollegiate athletic process as one that is outright exploitative of African people in particular. I'm looking here today at this article from March 18th, 2010, from UGA Today, News and Information from the University of Georgia. And this is an interview with a professor's research that, quote, shows black athletes exploited physically and neglected academically. I will spare you the entire article. Suffice it to say that the exploitation of African people is ongoing and is plain. And in the words of Professor Hawkins in his new book, his book from 2010, The New Plantation, this professor said, quote, as we examine the structure of intercollegiate athletics, the athlete is not necessarily the property of the institutions, but the rights to the athlete's labor and the profit off their labor makes the plantation model appropriate in examining the experiences of black male athletes. End quote. And of course, this is the slave plantation he's referencing. I want to move quickly now to a clip that I have of someone out of Texas. This is a student researcher on YouTube who compiled some pretty stunning facts just about the level of exploitation that occurs within college athletics, primarily to African people. I take you now, collegiate exploitation of athletes.
Are college athletes being exploited? This is a question as a UT sports fan you should ask yourself. Throughout many Division I campuses around the nation, there are prospective professional athletes who are bringing more revenue for the university than most faculty members. For instance, Vince Young and Kevin Durant are prime examples of revenue-attracting athletes. These first-class athletes typically are on a full-ride scholarship, which includes payment of their entire tuition and fees. Many people believe a free education is enough compensation for being an athlete. Last year alone, the University of Texas football team brought in $46.2 million of revenue. This is excluding the $8 million of merchandise sold by the University of Texas, as well as the $12 million a year that is generated through the club seating of Durrell K. Royal Texas Memorial Stadium. This is a substantial amount of money that is being managed by the self-sustaining athletic department. The amount of money that is being distributed to the players is hardly recognizable compared to the amount of revenue that they are helping contribute to the university. This growing fear gives them incentive to tolerate harsher working environments, even if being exploited. The National Collegiate Athletic Association has created rules that force students, athletes, to adapt to exploitation. When NCAA and the universities are exploiting student athletes, they are doing so to make profit. They do this by not compensating students, athletes like they should. Athlete exploitation does not happen monetarily. Athletes can be exploited by putting them into situations that are not in their best interests. For example, notice how college athletes tend to be grouped in the same college with the same major. This is not incidental. The sole purpose for this is to keep athletes in easier colleges with easier majors so they will be eligible to compete during the sports seasons. USA Today found a large percentage of football players at Auburn and Duke University, about a quarter and one-third of the team respectively, all majors in sociology, while tiny fractions of all undergraduate majors in that field. This shows that these universities' main purpose is not educating their athletes, but keeping them eligible to exploit them for their abilities and using their money for the university. Is this wrong? Many students believe a free education is enough compensation for any athlete. It is true that full scholarships cover a large majority of an athlete's education, but the NCAA denies universities the right to pay college athletes anything outside school-related expenses. The problem here is that anyone can get a scholarship. Non-athlete students at the university have the ability to get academic scholarships, but the difference between the two is that college athletes can't use their talents, whereas non-athlete students have no restrictions on using their special talents. For example, Michael Dell uses his ability to craft personal computers from his dorm room at the University of Texas and his entrepreneurial skills to start his billion-dollar business. College athletes are denied the right to use skills to develop sports to generate money. The only reason college athletes are not allowed to invest in their own financial future is because scholarships are assumed to be adequate means of compensation for the large amount of revenue they produce for the university. What about other athletes? Student athletes who are not on scholarships, also known as walk-ons, contribute to the funds produced by the university, but if scholarships are supposed to compensate them, then these walk-ons are going completely uncompensated. College athletes make a huge time commitment to the university and to their respective sports. These commitments disallow them to get a job. Taking away their ability to make any money for themselves might render their ability to go to school. Essentially, these student athletes are working for the university for free, which is an example of the definition of athletic exploitation. UT's very own Ricky Williams is a great example of a walk-on. He was not a scholarship athlete, but generated $1 million for UT. He broke over 20 NCAA records while at Texas and received the Heisman, but never even finished school. If he was allowed to accept endorsements, he would have continued school. Allowing endorsements would equalize the playing field for athletes who can't get jobs outside athletics. It would allow any athlete with God-given talent to take advantage of those talents. This right is naturally granted to any student in America besides student athletes. It is only fair to allow student athletes to fulfill their potential. Universities exploit players by denying student athletes the right to accept endorsements. The profits from all the endorsement deals are rewarded directly to the coach from the university rather than the players who are being represented. Coaches like Mack Brown don't need endorsements because without them, they are still making $3 million a season. Allowing student athletes to accept endorsements would help to close the gap between athlete scholarship compensation and actual expenses. Athletes who are able to accept endorsements will be more willing to give up their scholarships for the walk-ons who are not receiving any compensation. This will also contribute to stop exploitation of college athletes because they would essentially be getting a true all-expense-paid education. It is true that a student athlete who does not want to be exploited can walk away from the program. However, where does this leave the athlete with the desire to potentially play professional sports? College athletic programs are used by professional sports as a minor league proving ground. The chances of athletes reaching a professional level are virtually non-existent without the proper form to display their talent. As a fan of Texas sports, I want you to help stop exploitation of college athletes by voicing my message and informing others that the issue is real. If enough people become informed about this topic, we can create change. Maybe you can create change. Who knows? You could write a letter to the NCAA demanding the rules to change, start a petition, or even boycott NCAA tournaments. Think of a plan that will stop NCAA from taking advantage of these poor student athletes that bring us entertainment on a nightly basis.
Uhuru, I appreciate that. Thing. I want to put forward our new station engineer here for the Reparations in Action show, Darren St. Pierre. I'm not asking you to hook up your mic if you're not ready to, Darren, but you're really just doing a fantastic job, and I appreciate you helping out with bringing us those clips. So that was a breakdown in more specific terms than I'd be able to give you about the exploitative conditions for primarily African working class players, people that come from the colony, if you will. Marshawn Lynch is a prime example of this. I don't have the time to play the clip today, but his experience growing up in Oakland was one of abject poverty, of open police containment. But he also grew up in an area dominated politically by the history of the Black Power movement, the Black Panther Party, and the African People's Socialist Party, and Uhuru movement in particular. We're going to go to a clip briefly, or momentarily, from Marshawn Lynch that was caught at the beginning of this recent Super Bowl, forgive me. But before I do that, I just want to put that in context as well and say that this whole question of the excessive fines against players, like the fines that were levied against Marshawn Lynch, for instance, for refusing to speak to the press, because he's aware, I think, of the slanderous MO or modus operandi of the press these days toward African people in particular an African person with dreadlocks standing up for his community in Oakland. I think he's well aware of their goal there. And so it's very interesting what he does in this interview compilation when he's forced to appear. And also say that this is happening in the context of Ferguson and the Rams having come out against the intimidation of the police department and represented for Mike Brown, represented for the protesters in the streets, regardless of this intimidation and threats of fines and things that did not materialize. We're seeing the movement express itself through sports, and it is inspiring. I bring you now recent interview with Seahawks running back Marshawn Lynch.
I don't see y'all, but y'all mad at me. And if y'all ain't mad at me, then what y'all here for?
Actually, I'm not mad at
y'all. I ain't got nothing for y'all, though. I told y'all that, so y'all should know that. What's up, African? Shout out to my real Africans out there. Y'all got another minute to look at me, though. Shout out Oakland, California.
How you feeling today?
Shout out Westbrook.
Do I make a prediction in the last 20 seconds for the outcome of the game?
Then I'm finna sit here with my mouth closed and look at you.
Do I make a prediction or not really?
Uhuru. Shout out to my real Africans. Shout out to Oakland, said Marshawn Lynch. And we salute you, Marshawn Lynch, for having said that. This consciousness of African people as one people is something that the African People's Socialist Party and the African Liberation Movement have struggled to win the consciousness of in the Black community, in the white community, in the world community for years. And it's just brilliant to hear that expressed so clearly through Marshawn Lynch. That is a 57-second clip from just a few minutes, over 5 minutes, that is primarily silence. And it's really a bit of theatrical genius that Marshawn portrays there. The interesting thing also is that what was not included there was a clip where an African
interviewer, person from the press, asked Marchand about his work in the inner city, and he said, why don't you come into the inner city and talk to me about that? And this is regarding Marchand's, I believe, youth programs and other community programs that he has invested in his hometown of Oakland, California, where the Uhuru movement has long history and influence. Now, we do want to move quickly, if we have time, to a brief clip that takes this question of colonialism in sports to the international level. This is an entirely not different, but related subject, the World Cup, FIFA and colonialism. There's something called the Soccer Wars that happened in 1969, and we want to bring you a brief clip of that history right now. It happened between Honduras and El Salvador.
The 1969 war between Honduras and El Salvador is known as the Football War because the conflict coincided with qualifying games between the two countries for the Soccer World Cup of Mexico in 1970. For historians, the conflict had nothing to do with the result of the match, but was motivated because of economic and military needs of both countries' business class.
Honduras withdrew from Mercomún, and that produced tensions. Those worsened when the Honduran government expelled 300,000 Salvadorans to open up jobs for Hondurans during the agrarian crisis.
Forty-five years since the war, the military forces and political movements in Honduras insist that the relationship with El Salvador have never been better. The current generation appears to have overcome the strong nationalism built up in those days.
Nos ha servido como países a tener de repente un poquito.
It has been useful for both countries to become closer, because we are brothers, the closest ones in the region. We talk almost the same way, and it's not convenient to be fighting.
Hablamos de la misma manera. No conviene que nos estemos peleando.
En los dos sectores la población es muy parecida.
In both countries, the population is very similar. We're identical, even in what we eat. Historically, the people of El Salvador and Honduras always have been close, ever since the unity struggles headed by Francisco Morazan.
Las luchas de Morazan.
Polish reporter Richard Kampuszynski was working in Central America when he baptized the conflict as the Football War. Sport in the region is an escape for many social problems, not the reason for a confrontation between brother countries. Gerardo Torres, Telesur, Central America.
Uhuru, that was Telesur giving a brief description of what was known as the Soccer Wars, something to look into for another show as well. I did want to mention that in addition to that, we have seen in the past century, in 1974, Chile qualified for the World Cup. This is after Pinochet had overthrown, with U.S. support, the democratically elected Allende, the socialist friend of Fidel Castro, who was going to nationalize. And anyway, they turned the stadium there, the soccer stadium, into a place to massacre political enemies. And we want to see an end to that. We want to see more and more Muhammad Ali's. We want to see more Marshawn Lynch's. And we want to see more of sports being redeemed as a way for colonized and oppressed people to express their athletic genius. And that's really why we call on you to support the Uhuru Solidarity Movement and things like the African People's Education Defense Fund and the Tyrone Lewis Community Gym. Healthy expressions of physical fitness and competition that can build the community. We thank you for the show. We encourage you to go to Uhuru Solidarity/convention and register for our March 7th and 8th National Convention of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. You've been listening to Reparations in Action here on the Uhuru News Network. I want to thank Darren St. Pierre, our engineer, and the entire team here at Uhuru Radio. My name is Jamie Simpson, your host. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Don't miss out on next week's show. We look forward to it. Uhuru.